Reflections on the Revolution in France by Edmund Burke. First published in 1790. This reading is based on a text at the website www.earlymoderntexts.com. Reader, Mill Nicholson. Final one-third of Part 3. The Army. Has more wisdom been displayed in the constitution of your army than what we find in your plan of judicature? The able arrangement of this part is harder and more demanding of skill and attention, not only as of great concern in itself, but also as the third cementing principle in the new body of republics that you call the French nation. It is not easy to foresee what that army may eventually become. You have voted for a very large one, well equipped, at least fully equal to your apparent means of payment. But what is the principle of its discipline? Whom is it to obey? You have taken the wolf by the ears, and I wish you joy of the happy position in which you have chosen to place yourselves. The Minister and Secretary of State for the War Department is Monsieur de la Tour du Pin. This gentleman, like his colleagues in administration, is a most zealous asserter of the revolution, and an optimistic admirer of the new constitution that originated in that event. His statement of facts about the military of France is important, not only because of his official and personal authority, but also because it clearly displays the actual condition of the army in France, and throws light on the principles on which the Assembly proceeds in the administration of it. It may enable us to form some judgment about how far we in Great Britain should imitate the military policy of France. Monsieur de la Tour du Pin recently gave an account of the state of his department as it exists under the auspices of the National Assembly. No man knows it so well. No man can express it better. Addressing himself to the National Assembly, he said, "His Majesty has this day sent me to inform you of the multiplied disorders of which every day he receives the most distressing intelligence. The army threatens to fall into the most turbulent anarchy. Entire regiments have dared to violate the respect due to the laws, the king, the order established by your decrees, and the oaths they have taken with the most awful solemnity. Compelled by my duty to inform you of these excesses, my heart bleeds when I consider who they are that have committed them. Those against whom it is not in my power to withhold the most grievous complaints are a part of that very soldiery which until this day have been so full of honour and loyalty, and with whom I have lived as comrade and friend for 50 years. What incomprehensible spirit of delirium and delusion has led them astray? While you are tirelessly establishing uniformity in the empire, and moulding the whole into one coherent and consistent body, while the French are taught by you the respect that the laws owe to the rights of man, and that the citizens owe to the laws, the administration of the army presents nothing but disturbance and confusion. I see in more than one corps the bonds of discipline relaxed or broken, the most unheard-of pretensions avowed directly and without any disguise, the ordinances without force, the chiefs without authority, the military chest and the colours carried off, the authority of the king himself proudly defied, the officers despised, degraded, threatened, driven away, and some of them prisoners in the midst of their corps, dragging on a precarious life in the bosom of disgust and humiliation. The commandants of places have had their throats cut, under the eyes and almost in the arms of their own soldiers. These evils may eventually menace the nation itself. The nature of things requires that the army should never act but as an instrument. The moment it sets itself up as a deliberative body, and acts according to its own resolutions, the government, be it what it may, will immediately degenerate into a military democracy, a species of political monster that has always ended by devouring those who produced it. After all this, who cannot be alarmed at the irregular consultations and turbulent committees formed in some regiments by the common soldiers and non-commissioned officers, without the knowledge of their superiors, and even in contempt of their authority? Not that the agreement of those superiors could give authority to such monstrous democratic assemblies. Though the Minister of War informs the assembly that most of the army have not cast off their obedience, and are still attached to their duty, travellers who have seen the best-behaved units observe in them the absence of mutiny rather than the existence of discipline. This minister is surprised over the excesses he reports. To him it seems quite inconceivable that the troops should depart from their former principles of loyalty and honour. Surely his hearers know the causes of this only too well. They know the doctrines they have preached, the decrees they have passed, the practices they have permitted. The soldiers remember the October 6 march on Versailles. They recollect the French guards. They have not forgotten the taking of the king's castles in Paris and Marseilles, or the fact that the governors in both places were murdered with impunity. They do not abandon the principles of the equality of men, laid down so ostentatiously and laboriously. They cannot shut their eyes to the degradation of the whole nobility of France and the suppression of the very idea of a gentleman. The total abolition of titles and distinctions is not lost on them. But Monsieur de la Tour du Pin is astonished at their disloyalty when the doctors of the assembly have taught them, along with all this, the respect due to laws. It is easy to judge which of the two sorts of lessons men with weapons in their hands are likely to learn. As for the authority of the king, we can learn from the minister himself that it is of no more consideration with these troops than it is with anyone else. He tells the assembly, "The king has over and over again repeated his orders to put a stop to these excesses, but in so terrible a crisis, your cooperation has become necessary to prevent the evils that menace the state. You unite to the force of the legislative power that of opinion, still more important." So the minister asks the assembly to array itself in all its terrors and to call forth all its majesty. He desires that the grave and severe principles announced by them may give vigour to the king's proclamation. After this, we should have looked for civil and military courts, the breaking of some units, the decimating of others, and all the terrible means that necessity has employed in such cases to stop the progress of the most terrible of all evils. Particularly, one might expect that a serious inquiry would be made into the murder of commandants while their soldiers looked on. Not one word of all this, or of anything like it. After being told that the soldiery trampled on the decrees of the assembly promulgated by the king, the assembly passed new decrees and authorized the king to make new proclamations. After the Minister of War had stated that the regiments had paid no regard to oaths taken with the most imposing solemnity, they propose what? More oaths? The means that have been used to prevent the mischiefs arising from conspiracies, irregular consultations, seditious committees, monstrous democratic assemblies of the soldiers, and all the disorders arising from idleness, luxury, dissipation, and insubordination are, I believe, the most astonishing that ever occurred to men. It is no less than this. The king has promulgated in circular letters to all the regiments his direct authority and encouragement that the various corps should join themselves with the clubs and confederations in the several municipalities, and mix with them in their feasts and civic entertainments. This jolly discipline, it seems, is to soften the ferocity of their minds, to reconcile them to their bottle companions of other kinds, and to merge particular conspiracies in more general associations. That this remedy would be pleasing to the soldiers, as they are described by Monsieur de la Tour du Pin, I can readily believe, and however mutinous they are otherwise, I am sure they will dutifully submit themselves to these royal proclamations. But I question whether all this civic swearing, clubbing, and feasting would make them more disposed than they are at present to obey their officers, or teach them better to submit to the austere rules of military discipline. It will make them admirable citizens in the French manner, but not quite so good soldiers in any manner. The imbecility of any part of the puerile and pedantic system that they call a constitution cannot be laid open without revealing the utter insufficiency and harmfulness of many other parts. You cannot propose a remedy for the incompetence of the crown without displaying the feebleness of the assembly. You cannot deliberate on the confusion of the army of the state without disclosing the worst disorders of the armed municipalities. Monsieur de la Tour du Pin attributes the salvation of the municipalities to the good behaviour of some of the troops. These troops are to preserve the well-disposed part of those municipalities, confessed to be the weakest part, from the pillage of the worst disposed, the strongest. But the municipalities claim sovereignty, and want to command the troops needed for their protection. Indeed, they must command them, or court them. Because of the demands of their situation, and the republican powers they have obtained, the municipalities must relate to the military as masters, or servants, or confederates, or each in turn, or a jumble of all together, according to circumstances. What government is there to coerce the army except the municipality, or to coerce the municipality except the army? To preserve concord, where authority is extinguished at the risk of all consequences, the assembly tries to cure the illnesses by the illnesses themselves. They hope to preserve themselves from a purely military democracy by giving the military a corrupt interest in the municipal democracy. Once the soldiers come to mix for any time in the municipal clubs, cabals, and confederacies, a magnetic attraction will draw them to the lowest and most desperate part, bringing with them their habits, attitudes, and sympathies. The military conspiracies, which are to be remedied by civic confederacies, the rebellious municipalities, which are to be made obedient by providing them with the means of seducing the very armies of the state that are supposed to keep them in order, all these fantasies of a monstrous policy must worsen the confusion from which they have arisen. Disorders may be quieted at one time in one place, but they will break out in other places, because the evil is radical and intrinsic. All these schemes of mixing mutinous soldiers with seditious citizens must further weaken the military connection of soldiers with their officers, while adding military and mutinous audacity to turbulent craftsmen and peasants. To secure a real army, the officer should be first and last in the eye of the soldier, first and last in his attention, observance, and esteem. In your army, it seems there are to be officers whose chief qualification is calmness and patience. They are to manage their troops by electioneering arts. They must conduct themselves as candidates, not as commanders. By such means, power may be occasionally in their hands, so the authority by which they are to be nominated becomes of high importance. Control of the army. It is not clear what you will finally do, and it does not matter much while the strange and contradictory relation between your army and all the parts of your republic, as well as the puzzled relation of those parts to each other and to the whole, remain as they are. You seem to have given the provisional nomination of the officers, in the first instance to the king, subject to approval by the National Assembly. Men who have an interest to pursue are extremely good at discovering the true seat of power. They must soon perceive that those who can block appointments indefinitely are really making appointments. So the officers must look to their intrigues in that assembly as the only sure road to promotion. Yet by your new constitution they must begin their solicitation at court. This double negotiation for military rank seems to me likely to promote faction in the assembly itself, and then to poison the corps of officers with factions of a nature still more dangerous to the safety of government, and eventually destructive of the efficiency of the army itself. If the system were designed for just that purpose, it couldn't have been better done. Officers who lose the promotions intended for them by the Crown must join a faction opposed to the assembly that has rejected their claims, and must nourish in the heart of the army discontentment against the ruling powers. On the other hand, officers who secure promotion through an interest in the assembly must feel themselves to be only second, or worse, in the goodwill of the Crown, though first in that of the assembly, and must slight the royal authority that would not advance but could not hold back their promotion. If to avoid these evils you decide that command and promotion are to be decided purely by seniority, your army will become more independent of any external control, and more of a military republic. A king is not to be deposed by halves. If he is not everything in the command of an army, he is nothing. What is the effect of a power placed nominally in the hands of a head of the army, whom that army is not grateful to or afraid of? Such a figurehead is not fit for the administration of something that is of all things the most delicate, namely, the supreme command of military men. There is also the question of whether an assembly like yours, even if it did have another sort of organ through which to pass its orders, is fit for promoting the obedience and discipline of an army. It is known that armies have always given a very precarious and uncertain obedience to any senate or popular authority, and least of all will they yield it to an assembly that is to continue for only 2 years. The officers must totally lose the typical character of military men if they see, with perfect submission and due admiration, the dominance of orators, especially when they find that they have to pay court repeatedly to an endless series of those orators, whose military policy and command skills, if they have any, must be as uncertain as their duration is short. In the weakness of one kind of authority, the king, and the fluctuation of the other, the assembly, the officers of an army will remain for some time mutinous and quarrelsome, until some popular general, who understands the art of conciliating the soldiery, and possesses the true spirit of command, draws the eyes of all men onto himself. Armies will obey him because of his personal qualities. There is no other way of securing military obedience in this state of things. But the moment that event happens, this person, who really commands the army, is your master, the master of your king, your assembly, your whole republic. How did the assembly get their present power over the army? Chiefly by seducing the soldiers away from their officers. They have destroyed the principle of obedience in the critical link between the officer and the soldier, just where the chain of military subordination starts, and on which the whole of that system depends. The soldier is told he is a citizen, and has the rights of man and citizen. He is told that a man has the right to be his own governor, and to be ruled only by those to whom he delegates that self-government. It is very natural for him to think that he ought most of all to have his choice, where he is to yield the greatest degree of obedience. So he probably will do systematically what he now does occasionally, namely, exercise at least a negative in the choice of his officers. At present the officers are only permitted to have their positions, and only conditionally on their good behaviour. In fact, there have been many cases where they were dismissed by their corps. Here is a second negative on the king's choice, one that is at least as effective as the assembly's negative. The soldiers know already that the National Assembly has seriously considered whether they, the soldiers, ought to have the direct choice of at least some of their officers. When such matters are under discussion, it is not unreasonable to expect them to favour the opinion that is most favourable to their claims. They will not bear to be seen as the army of an imprisoned king, while another army in the same country, one with whom they are to feast and confederate, is to be considered as the free army of a free constitution. They will cast their eyes on the other and more permanent army. I mean the municipal army. That corps, they well know, does actually elect its own officers. They may not be able to see the reason why they are not allowed to elect a Marquis de Lafayette, or whatever his new name is, of their own. If this election of a commander-in-chief is a part of the rights of men, why not of theirs? They see elective justices of peace, elective judges, elective curates, elective bishops, elective municipalities, and elective commanders of the Parisian army. Why should they alone be excluded? Are the brave troops of France the only men in that nation who are not the fit judges of military merit, and of the qualifications necessary for a commander-in-chief? Do they, because they are paid by the state, lose the rights of men? They are a part of that nation themselves, and contribute to that pay. And is not the king, is not the National Assembly, and are not all who elect the National Assembly likewise paid? Coercing the peasants. With a government such as yours, everything depends on the army, for you have industriously destroyed all the opinions and prejudices, and, as far as you could, all the instincts that support government. The moment any difference arises between your National Assembly and any part of the nation, you must resort to force, because you have left yourselves nothing else. Your war minister tells you that the distribution of the army is in a great measure made with a view to coercing French nationals. You must rule by an army, and you have infused into that army, as well as into the whole body of the nation, principles which in time must disable you in your intended use of it. The king is to call out troops to act against his people. When the world has been told, and the assertion still rings in our ears, that troops ought not to fire on citizens. The colonies claim for themselves an independent constitution and free trade. They must be constrained by troops. In what chapter of your code are the rights of men? Can they read that it is a part of the rights of men to have their commerce monopolized and restrained for the benefit of others? As the colonists rise on you, the negroes rise on them. Troops again, massacre, torture, hanging. These are your rights of men? These are the fruits of metaphysical declarations, wantonly made and shamefully retracted? Only the other day, the farmers of land in one of your provinces refused to pay some sort of rent to the lord of the soil. In consequence of this, you decree that the country people shall pay all rents and dues, except the ones you have abolished as grievances, and you order the king to march troops against them if they refuse. The leaders of the present system teach the people to abhor and reject all feudality as the barbarism of tyranny, and they tell them afterwards how much of that barbarous tyranny they are to put up with patiently. These leaders are extravagant in throwing light on grievances, but the people find them to be extremely sparing when it comes to redress. When the peasants give you back the coin of sophistical reasoning, on which you have set your image and superscription, you dismiss it as counterfeit money, and tell them in future you will pay them with French guards and dragoons and hussars. To punish them, you wield the second-hand authority of a king, who is only the instrument of destroying, with no power to protect the people or himself. Through him, it seems, you will make yourselves obeyed. They answer, "You have taught us that there are no gentlemen. Which of your principles teach us to bow to kings whom we have not elected? We know without your teaching that lands were given for the support of feudal dignities, feudal titles, and feudal offices. When you took down the cause as a grievance, why should the more grievous effect remain? As there are now no hereditary honours, and no distinguished families, why are we taxed to maintain what you tell us ought not to exist? You have sent down our old aristocratic landlords as nothing but exactors under your authority. Have you tried to make these your rent-gatherers worthy of our respect? No. You have sent them to us with their arms reversed, their shields broken, so degraded and metamorphosed that we no longer know them. They are strangers to us. They do not even go by the names of our former lords. Physically, they may be the same men, but in all other respects they are totally changed. Why don't we have as much right to refuse them their rents as you have to cancel all their honours, titles, and distinctions? We never commissioned you to do that. It is one of the many instances of your assumption of undelegated power. We see the burghers of Paris, through their clubs, mobs, and national guards, directing you at their pleasure, and giving to you as law something which you then pass on as law to us. Through you, these burghers dispose of the lives and fortunes of us all. Why shouldn't you attend as much to the desires of the working farmer with regard to our rent, by which we are seriously affected, as you do to the demands of these insolent townspeople with regard to distinctions and titles of honour, by which neither they nor we are affected at all? But we find you pay more regard to their fancies than to our necessities. The basis for some of these arguments is ridiculous to all rational ears, but to the politicians of metaphysics, who have opened schools for sophistry and made establishments for anarchy, it is solid and conclusive. Obviously, the leaders in the assembly would not have had the least moral scruple about cancelling the rents along with the title and family ensigns. Doing that would be following the principle of their reasonings. But they had newly acquired by confiscation a great body of landed property. They had this commodity at market, and the market would have been wholly destroyed if they were to permit the farmers to riot in the speculations with which they so freely intoxicated themselves. The leaders have left nothing but their own arbitrary pleasure to determine what property is to be protected and what subverted. Nor have they left any principle by which any of their municipalities can be bound to obedience, or even conscientiously obliged not to separate from the whole to become independent or connect itself with some other state. The people of Lyons, it seems, recently refused to pay taxes. Why should they not? They could say to the assembly, "You are not our kings or states that we have elected, and do not proceed on the basis of principles on which we have elected you. So who are you?" And who are we to have no say in what taxes we ought or ought not to pay, and to be refused the powers whose validity you have approved in others? To this the answer is, "We will send troops." This last reason of kings is always the first with your assembly. This military aid may serve for a time, while the impression of the increase of pay remains, and the vanity of being umpires in all disputes is flattered. But this weapon, the army, will snap short, unfaithful to the hand that employs it. The assembly keep a school where, systematically and with unremitting perseverance, they teach principles and form regulations destructive to all spirit of subordination, civil and military. And then they expect to hold an anarchic people in obedience by means of an anarchic army. This national army, according to the new policy, is to be counterbalanced by the municipal army. The latter has a constitution that is much simpler, and in every respect less objectionable, than that of the national army. It is a mere democratic body, unconnected with the crown or the kingdom, armed and trained and officered, at the pleasure of the districts to which the various units belong. But if it is considered in any relation to the Crown, to the National Assembly, to the public tribunals, or to the National Army, or considered in the light of its lack of any coherence or connection between its parts, it seems to be a monster that can hardly fail to terminate its confused movements in some great national calamity. The Revolution's Handling of Revenue. Having concluded my remarks on the constitution of the supreme power, the executive, the judicature, and the military, and on the interrelations of all these, I shall say something about your legislator's performance with regard to the revenue. The proceedings in relation to this matter show even fewer traces of political judgment or financial resource. When the states met, it seemed that the great objective was to improve the system of revenue, to enlarge its collection, to cleanse it of oppression and vexation, and to establish it on the most solid footing. There were great expectations about that throughout Europe. It was by this grand arrangement that France was to stand or fall. And it became, very properly in my opinion, the test by which the skill and patriotism of those who ruled in that assembly would be tried. The revenue of the state is the state. In effect, everything depends on it, whether for support or for reformation. The dignity of every occupation wholly depends on the quantity and kind of virtue that can be exerted in it. All great qualities of the mind that operate in public, and are not merely suffering and passive, require force for their display. So the revenue, which is the spring of all power, becomes in its administration the sphere of every active virtue. Public virtue is of a magnificent and splendid nature, instituted for great things and dealing with great concerns. So it requires abundant scope and room, and cannot spread and grow under confinement and in tightened, narrow, and sordid circumstances. It is only through the revenue that the body politic can act in its true genius and character. It is from the revenue that magnanimity, liberality, beneficence, fortitude, providence, and the protection of all good arts derive their food and the growth of their organs. And continence, self-denial, labour, vigilance, frugality, and whatever else there is in which the mind shows itself above mere appetite, are nowhere more in their proper element than in the provision and distribution of public wealth. So it is not without reason that the science of theoretical and practical finance, which must call upon so many auxiliary branches of knowledge, stands high in the estimation not only of ordinary folk, but of the wisest and best men. And as this science has grown, along with the growth of economies, the prosperity and improvement of nations has generally increased with the increase of their revenues, and they will both continue to grow and flourish as long as the balance between what is left to strengthen the efforts of individuals and what is collected for the common efforts of the state is properly maintained, with the two being closely related to one another. So the objectives of a common finance minister are to secure an ample revenue, to impose it with judgment and equality, to employ it economically, and when necessary, to make use of credit, made secure by the clearness and candour of his proceedings, the exactness of his calculations, and the solidity of his funds. With this in mind, let us look at the merits and abilities of those in the National Assembly who have undertaken the management of this difficult business. A report by Monsieur Vernier from the Committee of Finances tells us that the amount of the national revenue, as compared with its product before the Revolution, far from having increased in their hands, was lessened by a sum equal to £8 million sterling, a reduction of well over 30%. If this is the result of great ability, never surely was ability displayed in a more distinguished manner or with so powerful an effect. No common folly, no everyday incapacity, no ordinary official negligence, even no official crime, no corruption, no theft, hardly any direct hostility which we have seen in the modern world could in so short a time have made so complete an overthrow of the finances, and with them of the strength of a great kingdom. The Salt Monopoly. As soon as the assembly met, the sophisters and declaimers began by decrying the previous constitution of the revenue in many of its most essential branches, such as the public monopoly of salt. They accused this of being badly designed, oppressive, and partial, and so it was. And they were not satisfied with saying this only in speeches, introducing some plan of reform. They also declared it in a solemn resolution, as it were judicially passing sentence on the monopoly, and they dispersed this sentence throughout the nation. At the time of this decree, they just as solemnly ordered the same absurd, oppressive, and partial tax to be paid until they could find a revenue to replace it. The consequence was inevitable. The provinces, that had always been exempted from this salt monopoly, were disinclined to bear any part of the burden, and the assembly, busy declaring and violating the rights of men, and arranging for general confusion, had neither leisure nor capacity to form any plan for replacing the tax or making it fairer. The people of the salt provinces, impatient under taxes, damned by the authority that had directed their payment, very soon found their patience exhausted. They thought themselves to be as skilful in demolition as the assembly could be. They relieved themselves by throwing off the whole burden. Animated by this example, each district, or part of a district, did as it pleased with other taxes. Other revenue attempts. Now let us see how they have gone about designing equal impositions that are proportioned to what the citizens can afford, and are the least likely to lean heavily on the capital that is at work generating the private wealth from which the public fortune must be derived. In allowing various districts, and various individuals in each district, to decide what part of the old revenue to withhold, they were introducing, instead of better principles of equality, a new inequality of the most oppressive kind. Payments were regulated by attitudes. The parts of the kingdom that were the most submissive, the most orderly, or the most well disposed towards the commonwealth, bore the whole burden of the state. Nothing turns out to be as oppressive and unjust as a feeble government. For a state without authority, what means were there to fill up all the deficiencies in the old impositions, and the new deficiencies of every kind that were to be expected? The National Assembly called for voluntary benevolence. For a quarter of each citizen's income to be estimated on the honour of the paying citizen. What they obtained in this way was far from enough to meet their real needs, and even further from their foolish expectations. Rational people would have hoped for little from this tax disguised as benevolence. A tax weak, ineffective, and unequal. A tax by which luxury, avarice, and selfishness were screened, and the load thrown on productive capital, on integrity, generosity, and public spirit. A tax of regulation on virtue. At length the mask is thrown off, and they are now trying, with little success, to exact their benevolence by force. This benevolence, the rickety offspring of weakness, was to be supported by another resource, the twin brother of the same prolific incompetence. The failure of the patriotic contribution was to be made up for by patriotic donations. By this scheme, they took things that were worth a lot to the giver, and of comparatively small value to the receiver. They ruined a number of trades. They pillaged the crown of its ornaments, the churches of their plate, and the people of their personal decorations. The invention of these juvenile pretenders to liberty was really just a servile imitation of one of the poorest resources of senile despotism. Whatever virtue there may be in these devices, it is obvious that neither the patriotic gifts nor the patriotic contribution can ever again be resorted to. The resources of public folly are soon exhausted. Indeed, their whole scheme of revenue is to make somehow an appearance of a full reservoir for the hour, while cutting off the springs and living fountains of permanent supply. Their other schemes of taxation have not yet been implemented, but nobody could think that they would do much to fill the hole that the Assembly's incompetence has made in their revenues. Their treasury is sinking every day in metal money and swelling in paper money. They imagine that our flourishing state in England is due to bank paper. In fact, the bank paper is due to the flourishing condition of our commerce, the solidity of our credit, and the total exclusion of all idea of power from any part of the transaction. They forget that in England not one shilling of paper money of any kind is received except by choice, that the whole mass of paper money had its origin in cash actually deposited, and that if one wants to convert any of it back into cash, this can be done in an instant and without the smallest loss. Our paper is of value in commerce because it has no standing in law. A creditor who was owed 20 shillings can legally refuse all the paper of the Bank of England, nor is there among us any public security that is enforced by authority. It is, in fact, easy to show that our paper wealth, instead of lessening the real coin, has a tendency to increase it, that instead of being a substitute for money, it only facilitates its circulation, that it is the symbol of prosperity and not the badge of distress. Well, but a lessening of extravagant expenses and the economy that has been introduced by the virtuous and intelligent Assembly make up for the losses sustained in the receipt of revenue. In this, at least, they have fulfilled the duty of a financier. Have those who offer this defence looked at the expenses of the National Assembly itself, of the municipalities of the city of Paris, of the increased pay of the two armies, of the new police, of the new judicatures? Have they even carefully compared the present pension list with the previous one? These politicians have been cruel, not economical. Comparing the expense of the former extravagant government in relation to its revenues with the expenses of this new system in relation to the state of its new treasury, I believe the present one will be found to be incomparably more guilty. Obtaining credit. It remains only to consider how ably the current French managers perform when they have to raise supplies on credit. Here I am a little at a loss, because, strictly speaking, they do not have any credit. The credit of the previous government was indeed not the best, but they could always raise money on some terms, not only in France but from most European countries, where surplus capital had accumulated, and the credit of that government was improving daily. The establishment of a system of liberty would naturally be expected to give it new strength, and so it would have done if a system of liberty had been established. What offers has this government of so-called liberty had from Holland, from Hamburg, from Switzerland, from Genoa, from England, for a dealing in their paper? Why should these nations of commerce and economy enter into any monetary dealings with a people who attempt to reverse the very nature of things, a people among whom they see the debtor prescribing at the point of the bayonet how he is to repay the creditor, paying off one debt by incurring another, turning his very poverty into his resource, and paying his interest with his rags? Their fanatical confidence in the omnipotence of church plunder has induced these philosophers to overlook all care of the public estate. These philosophical financiers expect this universal medicine made of church extract to cure all the evils of the state. These gentlemen perhaps do not believe much the miracles of piety, but they certainly have an undoubting faith in the prodigies of sacrilege. Is there a debt that presses them? Issue promissory notes. Are compensations to be made to those whom they have robbed of their freehold in their office, or expelled from their profession? Promissory notes. Is a fleet to be fitted out? promissory notes. If 16 million pounds worth of these promissory notes, forced on the people, leave the state's needs as urgent as ever, issue 30 million pounds worth of promissory notes, says one. Issue 80 million pounds more of promissory notes, says another. The only difference among their financial factions is on what quantity of promissory notes is to be imposed on the suffering public. They are all professors of promissory notes. All experience of their inefficiency does not in the least discourage them. Are the old promissory notes depreciated at market? What is the remedy? Issue new ones. Who but the most desperate adventurers in philosophy and finance could have thought of destroying the settled revenue of the state, the sole security for the public credit, in the hope of rebuilding it with the materials of confiscated property? When they had finally determined on a state resource from church plunder, the National Assembly passed a solemn resolution on the subject, promising their country that in the statement of the public charges for each year there should be brought to account a sum sufficient for defraying the expenses of the Roman Catholic religion, the support of the ministers at the altars, the relief of the poor, the pensions to the ecclesiastics of both sexes, so that the estates and goods that are at the disposal of the nation may be freed from all charges and employed by the legislative body to the great and most pressing needs of the state. In this resolution, they admit it to be their duty to show clearly the expense of the items they had promised would be the first to be provided for. They admit that they ought to show the estate clear and disengaged from all charges, and that they should show it immediately. Have they done this immediately, or at any time? Have they ever provided a rent roll of the immovable estates, or given an inventory of the movable effects that they confiscate to their promissory notes? How can they fulfil their engagements of holding out to public service an estate freed from all charges without authenticating the value of the estate or the amount of the charges? I leave it to their English admirers to answer. At length they have spoken out, fully revealing their abominable fraud in offering the church lands as a security for any debts or any service whatsoever. They rob only to enable them to cheat. But in a very short time, they defeat the purposes of the robbery and the fraud by making out accounts for other purposes that blow up their whole apparatus of force and of deception. The cost of maintaining Paris. Immense sums drawn from the vitals of all France have been used during the past year to nourish Paris. As long as Paris stands in the place of ancient Rome, so long she will be maintained by the subject provinces. It is an evil that inevitably accompanies the dominion of sovereign democratic republics. Rome, under her emperors, combined the evils of both systems, and this unnatural combination was one great cause of her ruin. It is a cruel and insolent imposition to tell the people that the dilapidation of their public estate is bringing them relief. Statesmen, before congratulating themselves on the relief given to the people by the destruction of their revenue, ought first to have carefully thought about the answer to this. Is it more advantageous to the people to pay considerably and gain in proportion, or to be freed from all contributions and gain little or nothing? I favour the first of these. Experience is with me, and so are the best opinions, I believe. The fundamental part of the skill of a true politician is the ability to keep a balance between the subject's power of acquisition and what the state demands from him. The means of acquisition are prior in time and in arrangement. Good order is the foundation of all good things. To be enabled to acquire, the people must be tractable and obedient, not servile. The magistrate must have his reverence, the laws their authority. The body of the people must not have the principles of natural subordination artificially uprooted from their minds. They must respect the property that they can't have a share in. They must work to obtain what can be obtained by work. And when they find, as they commonly do, that their success is not in proportion to the effort they have put in, they must be taught their consolation in the final distribution of divine justice. Whoever deprives them of this consolation deadens their industry, and strikes at the root of all acquisition as of all conservation. Someone who does this is the cruel oppressor, the merciless enemy of the poor and wretched, at the same time that by his wicked speculations he exposes the fruits of successful industry and the accumulations of fortune to the plunder of the negligent, the disappointed, and the unprosperous. Too many professional financiers are apt to see nothing in revenue but banks, circulations, annuities on lives, perpetual rents, and all the small wares of the shop. In a settled order of the state, these things are not to be slighted, and skill in them is to be respected. They are good, but only when they are built on that settled order. When men think that these beggarly contrivances can supply a resource for the evils that result from breaking up the foundations of public order, and causing or allowing the principles of property to be subverted, they will leave in the ruin of their country a melancholy and lasting monument of the effect of preposterous politics and presumptuous, short-sighted, narrow-minded wisdom. The effects of the incompetence, shown by the popular leaders in all the great organs of the Commonwealth, are to be covered with the all-atoning name of liberty. In some people, I see great liberty indeed. In many, if not in most, I see an oppressive and degrading servitude. But what is liberty without wisdom and without virtue? It is the greatest of all possible evils, for it is folly, vice, and madness, untutored and unrestrained. Those who know what virtuous liberty is cannot bear to see liberty disgraced by incompetent heads who have high-sounding words in their mouths. To make a government requires no great prudence. Settle the seat of power, teach obedience, and the work is done. To give freedom is even easier. There is no need to guide. It only requires letting go the reins. But to form a free government, i.e., to bring these opposite elements of restraint and liberty together into one consistent work, requires much thought, deep reflection, a sagacious, powerful, and combining mind. I do not find this in the leaders of the National Assembly. Perhaps they are not as miserably deficient as they appear. I rather believe it. If they were, it would put them below the common level of human understanding. But when the leaders choose to make themselves bidders at an auction of popularity, their talents in state construction will be of no service. They will become flatterers instead of legislators, instruments of the people, not their guides. If any of them proposes a scheme of liberty, soberly limited and defined with proper qualifications, he will immediately be outbid by his competitors, who will produce something more splendidly popular. Suspicions will be raised about his fidelity to his cause. Moderation will be branded as the virtue of cowards, and compromise as the prudence of traitors, until, hoping to preserve the credit that may enable him to temper and moderate on some occasions, the popular leader is obliged to become active in propagating doctrines and establishing powers that will later defeat any sober purpose he might eventually have aimed at. Conclusion. Am I so unreasonable as to see nothing that deserves commendation in the tireless labours of this assembly? I do not deny that some good things may have been done among the countless acts of violence and folly. Those who destroy everything are sure to remove some grievance. Those who make everything new have a chance that they may establish something beneficial. To give them credit for what they have done with the authority they have usurped, to excuse them for the crimes of which that authority was acquired, it must appear that the same things could not have been accomplished without producing such a revolution. Most assuredly they could. because almost every one of their regulations that is not very ambiguous was either a part of what the king voluntarily conceded at the meeting of the states, or contained in the concurrent instructions to the orders. Some usages have been abolished, and rightly so, but they could have stayed in place for ever without detracting much from the happiness and prosperity of any state. The improvements of the National Assembly are superficial, their errors fundamental. I would prefer, my countrymen, to recommend to our French neighbours the example of the British Constitution, rather than taking them as models for the improvement of our own. In their Constitution, they have an invaluable treasure. They are not, I think, without some causes of anxiety and complaint, but these are due not to their constitution, but to their own conduct. I think our happy situation is due to our constitution, but due to the whole of it, and not to any part singly, due in a great measure to what we have left standing in our several reviews and reformations, as well as to what we have altered or added. Our people will find employment enough for a truly patriotic, free, and independent spirit in guarding what they possess from violation. I would not exclude alteration, but even when I changed the Constitution, I would be doing this so as to preserve it. I would be led to my remedy by a great grievance. In this I would follow the example of our ancestors. I would make the repairs as nearly as possible in the style of the building. The ruling principles of our forefathers, in their most decided conduct, included politic caution, guarded circumspection, and moral rather than temperamental timidity. Not being illuminated by the light of which the gentlemen of France tell us they have such an abundant share, our forefathers acted with a strong sense of the ignorance and fallibility of mankind. God, who had made them like this, rewarded them for attending to their fallibility in their conduct. Let us imitate their caution, if we wish to deserve their fortune, or to retain their bequests. Let us add, if we please, but let us preserve what they have left, and, standing on the firm ground of the British Constitution, let us be satisfied to wonder at the aeronauts of France, rather than try to follow them in their desperate flights. I have told you candidly my sentiments. I think they are not likely to alter yours. I do not know that they ought. You are young. You cannot guide the fortune of your country, but must follow it. But hereafter they may be of some use to you, in some future form that your commonwealth may take. It can hardly remain in its present form, but before its final settlement it may be obliged to pass, as our poet Addison says, through great varieties of untried being, and in all its transmigrations to be purified by fire and blood. I have little to recommend my opinions, but long observation and much impartiality. They come from one who has been no tool of power, no flatterer of greatness, and who in his last acts does not wish to belie the tenor of his life. They come from one, almost the whole of whose public exertion has been a struggle for the liberty of others, from one in whose breast no lasting or vigorous anger has ever been kindled except by what he considered as tyranny. They come from one who has little desire for, and no expectation of, honours, distinctions, and wealth, who has no contempt for fame, and no fear of obloquy, who shuns quarrels, though he will risk voicing an opinion, from one who wishes to preserve consistency, but who would preserve consistency by varying his means to secure his end. And when the balance of the ship in which he sails is endangered by overloading it on one side, is desirous of carrying the small weight of his reasons to the other side, so as to preserve its balance. End of part 3. End of the work.